What? What are the terms and conditions of whatever? I see. It's a sentence fragment. Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Did you see that strategic pause? It's like those people do on the answering machine. It's just me today. There's no Kai Rizdahl. I'm holding down Make Me Smart on my own, the podcast where I just sit here in my basement and talk about tech culture and politics and business. Also, I have you guys, though. And this is important. It is especially important today that this is the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us, because it means I'm not alone. I have you. Kai Rizdahl is actually in Georgia talking to a blue jeans maker about NAFTA, as you do. And I just want to shout out to the person on Twitter, I forgot to put this in our rundown, who referred to our podcast as a collective wisdom platform. And soon I'm going to find his name and give him full credit. But it's like the evolution of none of us is as smart as all of us. Last week on the show, we asked him, for the last year, we have been asking big questions about capitalism. Last week, we talked about them with Umair Haque and whether it can solve issues of the 21st century, and if so, how. This week, we're going further down the radical economics rabbit hole to really analyze what a truly free market might look like and let you decide whether you think there is appetite for these kind of changes. We're also going to hear from you, the dear audience. Later in the show, you have been writing in with lots of comments and insights on the Sprint-T-Mobile proposed merger and 5G network technology. There will be a very important nerdy correction later in the show, too. And you guys, talk about a collective wisdom platform. We got everyone from cell tower climbers, yes, to land use lawyers writing in. So stay tuned for that. Before that, though, let's get right to our interview, which was accidentally suggested by, you got it, one of our listeners. Brianna Gonsalves wrote in to suggest that we talk about this new book called Radical Markets, Uprooting Capitalism and Democracy for a Just Society. Brianna said the book is very on theme with the things that we cover in this podcast. And Brianna, you were very on theme yourself. Today, we're talking to one of the two authors of that book, Glenn Weil. The book actually comes out today. Glenn is a principal researcher at Microsoft Research. He's a visiting scholar at Yale's Department of Economics, as well as the law school. He's a basic super smart person. He co-wrote Radical Markets with Professor Eric Posner. In the book, they argue that a lot of the challenges that we're facing as a country and probably a world, rising inequality and political instability, are actually worse because what we think of as free markets are in fact not free enough, which is sort of a counterintuitive, or it's just a, you know, it's a less common reaction to what is wrong with capitalism. So we started right in on the big ideas to change that. Here you go. Here's Glenn Weil. So you call rising inequality the most significant problem of our time. Rising inequality in wealthy countries, that's sort of, you know, that seems, sounds like the biggest thing to solve first. But I'm not sure that we see consensus on that point. You know, if you look at what leads news broadcasts or daily headlines or push alerts, it's not necessarily inequality this or inequality that. So why do you identify this as the big, as biggest problem, and what's at stake if we don't work on it?
I think that inequality is at the root of a lot of the conflict that we see. I think that the failure of people's living standards to rise above that of their parents, you could call it the death of the American dream, but it's also in Europe, the death of the hope that was the promise of industrialism and the Enlightenment, is what's leading to the populist backlash that we see around the world. And while in the news people may not put the word inequality, they might not put numbers like the top 1% on that, when you do the math, it comes down to a combination of that inequality with the stagnation of economies that are killing people's hopes for their future.
We also see headlines, though, that talk about anxiety, that talk about, you know, sort of concern about loss of place in society, and that that is also a big driver of some of these things, and that some of those, some of that anxiety is racial, some of it is, you know, sort of tribal in nature. Do you think that that stems from market-related issues, from inequality?
Not exclusively. I think that there are two big problems. It's not just that people are losing the sense of having a future, but also that our democratic institutions are increasingly incapable of coping with conflicts between minorities and majorities, and that they, increasingly have to turn to judges or international authorities to try to resolve those conflicts. And those institutions don't have the legitimacy that democracies have. So it's that combination of fear about the ability to have a better future with interrelated conflicts between groups that we can't resolve democratically that I think is the real crisis that's facing us.
But as we've seen, you know, kind of getting back to this anxiety idea, you know, people don't give up power willingly or resources willingly. You know, as you have these conversations and as you kind of explore this on the at the intellectual level, how do you think that change could actually come about? I mean, other than revolution?
you know? I think that...
Drew, I think we're all trying to hope to avoid.
absolutely. I believe very powerfully in the power of democracy and ideas. I think that the rhetoric of the free market has been incredibly powerful and important to defending the privileges of the current people who are restraining the market. And that is ultimately what defends existing power structures. And if we can undermine that, if we can take that away, if we can say that actually people are protecting monopolies and they are controlling markets and they are stopping a really free market from operating, I think that ultimately that will undermine so much of the relevant power, because that's how it arose. You know, Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, they all won the legitimacy for current institutions by the rhetoric of the market. And if we can take that rhetoric of the market away, and if we can turn it to the good of the broader society, I think that we can create a new coalition of people who truly believe in free markets and people who truly believe in equality, and undermine the standard left-right discourse, which is what is protected existed privilege.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I think we have talked about this idea of moral capitalism, or the, you know, whether capitalism itself has to have this kind of moral core. But it sounds like what you're saying is like, look, that's a loser. And it is, because it's judgmental. The point is literally reclaiming the original concept of free markets, which I think some argue got lost, that Adam Smith was arguing for.
Yeah, and not just Adam Smith. I mean, there's this guy named Henry George, who nobody knows about nowadays. But for 30 years, he was the best-selling author in the English language other than the Bible. And he had a vision of markets where he believed that the truest free market would create socialism. And he had a huge effect. You know, the progressive movement, an important namesake for it was his Progress and Poverty book. So, but his ideas were forgotten in the Cold War. And the rhetoric of the Cold War and the anti-communism and so forth has entrenched power and privilege that are holding back the ability of technology to advance, for us to have a more equal society. And we have to defeat those ideas. It may seem like entrenched power is the greatest thing that we're fighting, but entrenched ideas are far more powerful than entrenched power. If we can change people's ideas, if we can get these ideas out there in a way that people understand, I think we can change the world.
Well, then let's provoke a couple more a couple more thoughts in people's minds. For example, one person, one vote. A pretty, provoking concept, the idea of ending one person, one vote. That's pretty ingrained in Western culture, particularly American culture. What's the rationale behind throwing that out?
Well, I think everybody in the back of their mind knows that one person, one vote makes no sense for most decisions that we make. They're just used to assuming that it does. You think about gay marriage referenda. Clearly, that issue is vastly more important to some parts of the population than it is to others. Why should everyone have one vote on that? Clearly, many issues about ethno-racial minorities or other types of minorities, like religious minorities or gun owners, none of these make sense for everyone to have exactly equal influence. What we would want instead is for people to be able to make trades and compromises. where I give up the things that matter less to me for things that matter more to me. And it's only a stubborn attachment to assumptions of the past that I think would lead it to seem crazy that we want to move beyond a system that's so rigid and focused on some specific numerical rule rather than actually trying to achieve the greatest good for as many people as we can. So I think One Person, One Vote, in fact, is responsible for so many of the failings of recent years, from the rise of populism to how dissatisfied we are with our politicians to how much local politics is full of people who don't even know who's running for the local city council, transient people like me who don't even know what the offices are and yet are muddying up the vote by weighing in. Of course, it should be people who are more attached to the community that make those decisions. And the ability of people to trade and to focus on the things that are most important and that they're most knowledgeable about would make our electoral system work far better.
And then let's talk about immigration. You have a whole chapter on immigration. You describe the forces that have, you know, sort of led us to where we are now. And you point out, among other things, that immigration wasn't really even a concern before the 20th century. And then you actually propose in the book your own system of immigration, a visas between individuals program. What does that mean?
So the idea is that right now, the way that you can come to the United States or Europe is usually through the sponsorship of some corporation that's going to employ you. And that ends up meaning that all the benefits of migration accrue either to the migrant herself or to the company that employs her. And that means that ordinary citizens of wealthy countries don't see many direct benefits from migration. And it's therefore not that surprising that we see such a backlash against migration. And yet migration offers so much opportunity to so many people in the world. If we could have a freer system of migration, we could reduce so much of the inequality in the world, and we could create a huge amount more wealth within wealthy countries. So how do we address that? Well, we need to give the benefits from migration to ordinary people in wealthy countries. And we can do that by allowing them to sponsor migrants and to negotiate with those migrants for a share of the benefits that the migrant derives from moving. And that's the basic idea of the Visa Between Individuals program. There's all sorts of details about how you protect migrants from exploitation and, you know, how the system would be administered, how people would navigate it, et cetera. But I think the basic point is that right now there are millions of people who would take a significant chance of dying to have a chance to come to wealthy countries. And we see that through illegal migration. We see that through a whole range of different ways. And offering them an opportunity to better their lives in that way, even if maybe there is some abuse in the process, is a tremendous opportunity for everyone in the world to live in a more just society.
If the radical reshaping of markets that you envisioned came to pass, would there be borders? You know, I mean, is it essentially just a global economy then?
Eventually, I'd like to see borders fade. Entirely disappear is wrong because, of course, there are some borders sort of within the United States. You can cross state boundaries and different states have different responsibilities. And even though there's not checkpoints at all those borders, you fall under different jurisdictions, right? And so I do believe that government should not all be at some one global level that's detached from local people. But the nature of borders might well change dramatically in the future. It's not all necessarily going to be geographic.
Yeah.
You know, some of it might have to do with the social networks that you're part of or different groups that you identify with.
That was Glenn Weil, one of the authors of Radical Markets, Uprooting Capitalism and Democracy for a Just Society. And as you probably gleaned from just this sort of like 12-minute situation, there are a lot of very provocative and really well thought out ideas in there. And it is more than worth a read. It's really interesting. You may fall slightly into the rabbit hole of how would this ever happen. But I asked him you know, how he thinks that these ideas are going to take root and how he's going to sort of create this will for radical change. And I should point out here that he said he's starting with the youth. He believes the children are the future. What a concept. Thank you to my producers who, during that interview, went and found the tweeter who said that we were the earworms of wisdom and that we have created a collective wisdom platform. It's Vox Fulman. I'm just going to give you the Twitter name, Vox Fulman. And then you'll find their real name, and it'll be like I didn't protect their privacy at all. Speaking of which, there is another bold point in that book, in Radical Markets. It's chapter 5, and it's called Data Labor. It is super relevant, obviously, to what we've been talking about on the show. The authors point out that right now, we are all essentially unpaid data laborers for not only companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google and credit card companies and Target and everybody else, but we're essentially unpaid data laborers for building artificial intelligence systems and machine learning, which rely on data to get smarter. And they say that this bargain, what we get in return, which is like you need to leave in 5 minutes so that you make it to your meeting or even your credit card company and saying we noticed a spending pattern that's out of whack, that bargain is still very unequal. These companies get more out of our labor than we do. And so they propose a system to try to quantify the value of our data and get us paid for it. And I talked to him about that this week, to Ed Glenn Weil, on Marketplace Tech. So if you want to hear that portion of the interview, please subscribe to the podcast or listen at marketplacetech.org. It's super interesting. I think I talked to this guy for 35 minutes, which is somewhat unheard of in the radio world, and would have talked to him for at least an hour longer. All right. Obviously, since he had so many ideas, I did. One of the things that took up a lot of our time, actually, was Glenn Weil's pause after I asked him the Make Me Smart question. What's something you thought you knew, but you later found out we were wrong about? And let me tell you guys, we have had some long pauses in response to this question. People have to take a hot second to think about it. And Glenn took like a hot half hour and he said this.
I think I once thought I knew that academic economics was a field of expertise and that the smarter you got and that the more that you knew, the more of a difference you could make, the more you could solve the problems of the world. I think I've come to realize that courage is much more important than intelligence, and that many of the problems that we face are not subtle, they're hard. And that's something that has changed my life in a lot of ways and has changed the mission that I feel that I have as an intellectual and public intellectual.
It's kind of meta and challenging, actually, to sit here and think that as co-host of a podcast called Make Me Smart, it might not be enough. Make you courageous. Make us courageous. Also, I did not even know that academic economics was a thing, but it's super fun to say. You can send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question, pause and all, recorded on your phone with a voice memo. We love those, please. And then email it to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We also love to know what you're smart about also, because Collective Wisdom Platform, you can tell us what you know via our website, makemesmart.org. We are going to hear more of your wisdom next, but first, we're going to pay the bills.
Dear Make Me Smart.
My name's Jessica from Austin.
This is Stephen Gillivray from Fountain Hills, Arizona.
This is Sandra Bond in Newport, Oregon.
It is your turn to make us smart. So many of you wrote in about the Sprint T-Mobile merger, and you had lots of opinions about it, which is not that surprising because like everybody uses a cell phone. The listeners, I'm just going to say, sometimes this happens with tech topics. No judgment involved, but we got like most of our feedback from the dudes. Just wondering where my telecom ladies are. We want to hear what you think too. But before we get started, let's get this out of the way. I made a mistake, as sometimes happens during extemporaneous speaking, last week when I was talking about the difference between 4G and 5G, and so many of you caught it. And I said that, for example, your home network is measured, your speeds are measured in megabits and gigabits. That's what we're talking about. I said megabytes and gigabytes, which is such a rookie mistake, you guys. I'm so embarrassed. Thank you to all of you who caught it. There were lots of you. All right, moving on to the actual information. Justin Zimbalik left us a voice memo about his past experience with T-Mobile and what could be in store for would-be customers of a Sprint-T-Mobile merger.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name's Justin from Washington, D.C., and I have a suggestion about a potentially consumer-friendly merger. And in fact, it involves T-Mobile. In 2012, T-Mobile merged with MetroPCS, which was another wireless carrier. And in the following years, T-Mobile implemented many pro-consumer policies, like the introduction of an unlimited data plan, total abolition of carrier contracts, and a much more flexible device purchase plan, most of which were then copied by the other carriers. My service also improved tremendously during that time. T-Mobile's track record in the last 5 years and the continued presence of pro-consumer CEO John Legere is why I'm cautiously optimistic about the T-Mobile and Sprint merger.
I got to agree with you that T-Mobile has been a very consumer-friendly carrier. Some analysts might argue that they've been a consumer-friendly carrier in service of attracting customers, which wouldn't be so hard after they merged, and then maybe they wouldn't be. But I also like to believe that they would be. And I'm going to say that I got a tweet just right before we started the show from a Sprint customer who said, I also want this to happen because I don't think Sprint is going to continue to exist and couldn't continue to exist without T-Mobile. So we might have ended up with three carriers anyway, and T-Mobile would have been the weaker for not acquiring Sprint, which I thought was a very interesting perspective. Terry Smith wrote in to us with this super fascinating perspective about the infrastructure changes needed to accommodate 5G, and he sent in this voice memo.
I'm a tower climber, and hearing you talk about the race for 5G makes me worried for other climbers out there. There was a study done by Frontline and ProPublica in 2012 reporting on tower climber deaths during the 3G and 4G boom. It's a great piece about the disconnect between the big cell carriers and the small percentage of subcontractors that skimp on safety in order to meet very strict deadlines from carriers to be the first with the new network. Anyway, I wanted to highlight that and say I love the show. Thanks.
That is fascinating, and I had no idea. And I think that's something I'm going to read those stories, and thank you so much for, once again, a perspective that I had no idea about. My understanding about 5G is that the actual radios and infrastructure are installed closer to the ground, so hopefully it's a little bit safer, but I could be completely wrong about that. And any time that companies are in a hurry, there is a risk that safety will be left by the wayside. Ken Schmidt works for a consulting firm that assists landowners and tower owners with cell site lease issues, because you guys do a little bit of everything. And he left us this message.
Overall, I am staunchly opposed to the Sprint-T-Mobile merger from an anti-competitive standpoint. But from a 5G standpoint, it certainly makes a more compelling case. To me, left alone, neither Sprint nor T-Mobile will be able to compete effectively with AT&T or Verizon in 5G.
This is also an excellent point that gets to that idea that if these two smaller carriers, that frankly, this might be what it takes, that our telecom economy is so out of whack, that AT&T and Verizon are so big, and this infrastructure is so expensive that there may be no other way to introduce real competition for them, which is kind of its own sort of bummer. All right, and we just had to end with this. We're going to take a break from tech for a minute and read a shortened version of an email that basically made me burst into tears. Kyle Banner wrote to us after our cash bail episode, and he said he had never heard about the problems with the bail system before that our guests, Robin and David, discussed, and that he said, thanks to Make Me Smart and the Bail Project, and my donation, he said, should help at least one family a year avoid the awful side effects of being stuck in jail because they are poor. And now I might tear up again. And that was wonderful. And he said that we had ended that interview sounding a little hopeless about things and the world and the state of the criminal justice system. And he learned a new thing and then was able to have like a direct line to action, which made us feel awesome. Thank you. And please keep it coming. As you can see, we learn probably more in this part of the show than almost any other part of the show, and we are so grateful. So please keep emailing us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Leave us a comment on the website. You can obviously tweet directly to us at Kai Rizdahl, at Molly Wood. And if you don't already subscribe and you're just hearing this as a drive-by, please do. And leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend. I'm going to stop pitching now. And we'll see you next week. Don't worry, Kai will be back. And I'll have someone else to talk to. I shouldn't say that because, you guys, I have plenty of people to talk to. The control room in Los Angeles is full of people. For example, Make Me Smart is produced by Christopher Olin and Shara Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Tro. This week's program was engineered by Drew Justad. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And the very well-behaved dog that I just noticed behind me is Reggie. He sneaked in, you guys, but he didn't make a peep. See you next week.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.